Former Congresswoman Corrine Brown is found guilty on 18 of 22 counts. Wildfires plague Southeast Georgia and Northeast Florida, and more names tossing their hats into the ring in the governor's race. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen there or on iTunes, and stream us live on Facebook. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, how the Players Championship is getting a hole-in-one for charity here on the First Coast. Plus, we've got an important reminder for women from a breast cancer activist who'll be speaking at WJCT next week. All of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome our own WJCT reporter, Ryan Bank. Good morning.
Good morning.
Blogger Fred Matthews in studio.
Good morning, Melissa.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
I escaped the courthouse.
And making his debut on this panel, welcome to David Cotton from the Financial News and Daily Record. Hey, David.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Guys, so good to have you here in studio and so much to discuss this Friday. From the wildfires raging around the region to the 2018 campaign for Florida governor, adding two major new candidates this week. We'll tell you about that and more. But our top story this Friday, it is a guilty verdict on 18 of 22 counts against former North Florida Congresswoman Corrine Brown. Thursday, the federal jury handed down its decision, including a guilty verdict on the most serious charge, conspiracy to commit mail and wire fraud. Brown is accused of using a sham nonprofit that bilked more than $800,000 from donors. After the verdict was announced, Brown's attorney James Smith said his client maintains her innocence and plans to appeal.
You should look out for some motions that we will be filing for a new trial. I can't give you the reasons for those motions, but they will be coming soon, and that will continue to fight.
We're going to begin the roundtable with an in-depth look at the guilty verdict in the trial of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. What do you think of this verdict? Get on the line now, 549-2937. Go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can weigh in on Facebook. We already have quite a few comments there. We'll get to some of those in just a moment. A few of you have been in court for some time covering this. From the beginning to the end, let's begin with our own reporter, Ryan Bank. Ryan, did it seem as though the jury was going to go this way, or was there suspense as we waited on the verdict?
Well, I think people really try not to make predictions. A lot of people in the press tried not to, although, you know, there were whispers about, you know, a hung jury. But we were looking at 22 different counts, and the jury had to reach unanimous verdict on each one of those in order for a conviction. Personally, I think it was a little surprising. It was as high as 18. But at the same time, the prosecution had reams and reams and reams of evidence, and they called a lot of witnesses, and the defense really didn't have a whole lot to counteract that kind of airtight case.
Fred Matthews, the prosecutors in this case argued that Brown inflated her charitable giving to receive larger tax refunds, that she failed to disclose income. They painted her as a politician who was living beyond her means. Her attorney, though, said it was her chief of staff who was the mastermind in this whole endeavor. The jury didn't buy that argument for the most part.
It's hard to plead that you're incompetent when you have ran for 25 years on being competent. And that was just a thing that the jury had to get over. An interesting point about this is as soon as they got rid of that one juror off of the case, boom, within 24 hours, they have a conviction. So it means also that apparently the other persons who were on the jury at the time had pretty much made up their minds. This was a blip that occurred, probably, as always with these juries. All the personalities get together and one doesn't gel. But as soon as they got rid of that one personality and brought the other one in, they were pretty much ready to go. But, I mean, that was a big thing. How can you argue that I didn't know I was incompetent. I didn't know how to run my finances. But yet, here you are for 25 years. You're a part of running the country's finances.
It's 549-2937. A.G. Gankarski, it has been fascinating to see unveiled just how many stout and influential donors were all too eager to stroke a check to Congresswoman Brown and not ask a lot of questions about where the money was going.
Yeah, and that's the thing about this case. There is donor complicity because you've got donors who have millions, hundreds of millions, even $1 billion in some cases, Florida Democratic Party Chair Stephen Battelle among them, some of our local donors, and they gave without vetting the charity. If they wanted to give to help children, they would have given to a recognized charity, not something that Corrine Brown came up with. And this is the issue. They wanted to give unaccountable money to Corrine Brown. We have to keep this in mind. They wanted to give money that wasn't on the campaign account, wasn't on the PAC account, wasn't on the legal defense account. So how do you give? You give the one door. And, you know, they did that. And this is something that hasn't come up in much of the coverage of the trial, but the donor class, which, you know, likes to basically push issues in exchange for giving politicians money. Time after time, you know, they gave the money. And on the stand, they all said the same thing. If I'd known this was going for Corrine Brown, I wouldn't have given the money. Well, you know, if you'd done your due diligence like you do in every other business deal, you would have known.
And let us know your thoughts about the verdict in the trial of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. 549-2937. David Cotton with the Daily Record. We now look to the sentencing phase, and Judge Timothy Corrigan has a lot of discretion in the sentencing.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we're not going to hear anything on that front for a couple of months now, but you know, I'm sure everybody is waiting to see what's handed down. I mean, Corrine Brown, well-known figure in Jacksonville. It's a lot of eyes are going to be on there for sure.
And let me ask you your thoughts on some feedback we're getting on social media. Here's a comment on our Facebook page from Susan. How about comparing this to other cases? Look at Tom DeLay. Did he go to jail? I think he did, actually. But Brown's conviction has me thinking about this and whether she was unfairly targeted. Other people have gotten away with similar things, she writes. Ryan Bank.
I think that's... that's a take that a lot of people almost immediately were using on social media. You know, oh, if this had been someone else, she wouldn't have been convicted. I don't know if that really passes the smell test, because if you were in the courtroom and you saw the evidence and you looked at how meticulous the prosecutors were and all of the witnesses that were called, and then you looked at what the defense really was, which it just kind of hinged on blaming it all on Chief of Staff Ronnie Simmons and saying that she was an aging woman who couldn't, who relied heavily on her staff and couldn't handle her own personal finances. Quite obviously, we have a history in this country of systematic racism and bias and privilege. But I mean, I don't know how you apply that to this case. And I think actually in terms of other people that have gotten off, that's exactly what Smith is, James Smith, her lawyer, is depending on. He mentioned it yesterday in the gaggle after the verdict. He said, remember Governor McDonald from Virginia, who had a very high profile corruption trial, was convicted, and the conviction was overturned. So as he said, this is just phase one. He's going to be filing a motion to get a new trial. And, you know, there's at least 90 days that Corrigan has to make a decision on sentencing. So this is by far not the end of the story.
And Fred, high profile friends and associates of the former Congresswoman saying how devastated they are by this. State Senator Audrey Gibson, Bishop Rudolph McKissick, and other prominent citizens of Jacksonville, very sad about this.
Well, I mean, it didn't go, nobody could ignore the fact that for the morning walk-in, she had an escort every day, a different choreographed escort, whether it have been Reverend McKissick Jr., Reverend McKissick Sr., one of the members of the Montfort Point Marine. It just, the pastor who just got married to Omarosa even escorted her in one day.
Right. The Trump administration official, Omarosa Manigault, she's married to a guy here in Jacksonville.
Yeah. Reverend Fred, escapes my name, but anyway, she had a escort every day with this, and it was an indication of the number of friends that she's acquired over the years. And we're talking about not just Congress, we're talking about all the way back to her time in the Florida legislature. And this is a local girl. She graduated from Stanton High School, was a majorette. Everybody up there on Myrtle Avenue, around 8th and 9th and 10th Street, knows of Corrine back then. So this is not someone that is unknown to that community. But be that as it may, You know, a lot of those people are hurt, but equally happy about this is those persons, those Kareem haters, many of them who don't even live in the district, never had a part of it, who simply hated her being in office. They hated the sight of her, and anything they could do to get this done was what happened here. Now, what was the source of all of this? Because it could have been done 20 years ago when she had the travel agency. Everybody recognizes that, but it wasn't done then. So why now? Why at this point? What's the source of this? And that's what grates on the nerves of so many of the supporters, is that this is not new business. So why now would this come up?
AG. But
it's happened.
Yeah, I'm piggybacking on that because motivation is key here. You know, you look at the federal case, it was something they built from 2009 to 2014. They looked at one door, of course, but they look at pass-throughs also. Money that went into accounts like the Community Rehabilitation Center of Councilman Reggie Gaffney. Money went through Von Alexander's Alexander Agency. And fake donations like to Edward Waters College, where she supposedly gave furniture, was actually there before the turn of the century. And, you know, that's the thing. The most devastating testimony in this case was from people who were part of the Corrine Brown machine. Von Alexander was arguably the most devastating witness because Von did everything she could for Corrine Brown, and she got up there in the stand and said, "You don't tell Corrine Brown no." Ronnie Simmons said the same thing. And, you know, so you've got to balance, you know, the local supplicants and hangers-on and handholders, you know, with the people who are in her direct employ who said, "Hey, look, Corrine set this up." Were they trying to save themselves from prosecution? Were they trying to save themselves from inquiry? Perhaps. That's something that may come up with this motion for a new trial. But the most devastating part of this case was Corrine's machine turning on Corrine.
All right, let's go to your calls right now. 549-2937, do you agree with this verdict? Disagree? Ed in St. Augustine. Hey, Ed, good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Hey, I'm on a board for a 501c3 nonprofit, and we're very transparent, and we have a great board, and that's important. But I've also been a member of a 501c3 where I asked the president for information about the finances, and they said, "You will not know that." I think you have a whole program just on nonprofits and how they're regulated, which, from my understanding, they aren't. There's like somebody told me there's maybe three people in the IRS that deals with all the nonprofits in Florida. So are there other politicians that are using these nonprofits to launder money? And how was she directly?
I'd say the short answer is yes. Thank you for that question, Ed. Yeah. Ed, you have such a good point. Thank you for that. David Cotton, once you get that 501c3 designation, you're on the honor system.
Absolutely.
For the most part, you are. And there's a lot of wiggle room there if your intentions might be less than honorable.
Well, and absolutely. And I think there's also something to be said that, you know, if you're an elected official, you're someone who has a big, personality like a Corrine Brown, you know, you're going to be expected to act a certain way and use your influence to better a charity and not have so much weight with it. Yeah.
Ryan Bank.
I sort of want to go back to something that AG was saying and want to expand on that. And that is, there's a couple of things we have to remember. This investigation began under the Obama administration. So the idea that she's being targeted and the insinuation that it could possibly be this new administration, I understand the emotions behind this, but I don't think that holds water. And the second thing here is, at the end of the day, one person getting off for a crime somewhere else does not necessarily mean that another person isn't guilty. I mean, what would be the answer then to this issue with Corrine Brown? Would you have not prosecuted her at all?
I think those are all excellent points. Fred Matthews, at the same time, I think the reactions that we're seeing to this verdict are just indicative of the deep divisions and the pain in this community.
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, as I said, there are many folks out there who want it, who've been looking for this, something to happen to Corrine for years. And basically, you could argue that she gave it to them, I mean, by this. There are ways as we all know, for politicians to raise money and to get themselves taken care of. It's now almost been legalized with the PACs that every major politician sets up when they go into office, especially on the national level, that's set up to take care of all of the issues like travel and meals and all these other things you have to do. So, but the problem that most black politicians have when they get in office is they go into office without a whole lot of money. Without any money. No business. They don't have a business set up. They're not millionaires when they go in. Half of our city council right now are millionaires when they went into
city
council.
You get into office without any money, and yet, and suddenly you're thrust into a world where you're expected to play at a higher level. Well,
yeah, and you don't have to do that. It's what we tell our children. You don't have to do what everybody else in the class is doing, but they want to do it, and they get into it, and this is one of the results of that. But you're right. We cannot make excuses for this. Jesse Jackson Jr. served time. Mm-hmm. Okay, the congressman in Louisiana served time for stashing away the cash. We have a congressman now up in New York State. He's going to serve, Chaka Fatah, I think, is it? He's going to serve some time.
So what you're saying is, whether it's Cream Brown or another politician who gets into office without family money, business money, spouse money, you're surrounded by colleagues who have a lot of money. Sometimes this can lead to very bad decisions.
Yeah, but it's not an excuse because we had Charlie Bennett here who served for a quarter of a century in this seat that was only the only congressman basically for Jacksonville. He didn't get into anything. He lived within his means. He didn't take the raises that they offered when Congress started raising money. He had family problems just like everybody else did, but he didn't do this.
And here's a tweet from Chris Hand, former chief of staff to Mayor Alvin Brown. The pastor whose name Fred is trying to recall is John Allen Newman.
Yes.
All right, thank you for that tweet. That's the guy married to Omarosa. Sean in Orange Park. Go ahead, Sean. You're on the air.
Yes. My only concern of how this was handled was it was disclosed that this has been investigated for 10 years. I've never heard an investigation run that long. And couldn't a lot of this been prevented if they would have maybe nipped it in the bud?
Thanks, Sean. And we've also received a call from someone pointing out that One Door never officially apparently registered as a 501c3. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
No, that's their registration lapsed, and that actually came up during the trial because one of the donors said, hey, you're not actually a 501c3. One donor said that. The others didn't bother investigating.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Okay. Vicki in Fernandina Beach. Go ahead, Vicki.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is, who's paying for Kareem Brown's legal defense?
Thanks for that question.
The Legal Defense Fund.
Yeah, she set up a fund. David Cotton, she set up a fund some time ago.
Yes, she did, absolutely. We weren't in the courtroom at the Daily Record every day for this, so I'm going to defer to Ryan on that one.
Well, I guess I'll defer to AG, but AG, it was originally set up for redistricting, right?
But it's a kind of a catch-all. I mean, when she dropped the redistricting action right around the time this started to heat up, so she had the Legal Defense Fund, and you know, we're talking about Corrine Brown's finances. She clearly was the most careful financial manager in the world, so why not just roll it over? But yeah, she's had to sell a beach house. She's had to sell a lot of things. And a real question going forward in the appeal process and the motion process is how much can she actually afford? The defense didn't have an accountant. You know, they just basically had James Smith and one investigator, and they're going up against a phalanx of IRS, FBI, federal attorneys. You know, it wasn't a fair fight. I mean, you have, you know, basically guerrilla warfare against the feds, and you don't win that way.
And that's the point of what we've been discussing. There isn't a whole lot of there. I mean, the base salary is $174,000 a year. You get to travel on the credit card that you get, the same type of thing you got in a state legislature, you get on the national level. So there's not a whole lot of money there. She has no other side business. So all of this is being paid out of what her current assets are, and that's very little there for them to pull from. And remember, she went through how many attorneys before we got to this one? Four, at least, before we got to this guy who decided to go ahead and soldier on and try the case. So, no, there isn't a whole lot of money. And rolling money over from that activity, the districting activity, to this, there are a few dollars going into that, but there's not going to be a whole lot of money to pull from.
It has been riveting and, frankly, I think sad to watch this drama play out. and all four of you providing amazing insights to this. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we discuss the top stories of the week and other big news to talk about. Keep calling in at 549-2937, and because also making headlines this week, you likely smelled the acrid odor when you woke up this morning. We've all seen the smoke. Yes, Jacksonville has extended its burn ban in reaction to the hot and dry weather conditions and the wildfires raging through the area. Bonfires, campfires, and other fires are restricted through June 1st or until weather improves. That update announced Thursday by Mayor Curry as smoke from the West Mims wildfire in the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge near the Florida-Georgia line forced the Duval County Public Schools to cancel all outdoor activities yesterday. Jacksonville Fire Chief Curtis Wilson says all eyes are on the West Mims fire in Georgia, and Jacksonville residents should be taking extreme precautions.
We continue to have fires daily here in Jacksonville. 1 acre, 2 acres, brush fires, woods fires. And those fires are being started from folks inadvertently. Campfires, you know, trying to burn leaves, discarded smoking, things like that. So this is an effort to try to reduce that. We have a lot of beautiful greenery in this city, and we want to make sure that doesn't go up in flame.
All right, so stay inside. Keep the AC running. Keep your filter clean. There may be evacuations in parts of Nassau County here in our listening area. It's nothing to take lightly. This is a serious situation. Ryan.
I mean, a lot of people have sort of made light of it, and I don't think that's always in the best taste. But what they have said is that it looks like one of cities in East Asia, like Shanghai or something like that, that have smog advisories on the regular. It's a scary thing, especially for anyone who's pregnant, especially for anyone that has asthma or any other underlying conditions. I think people should be looking at buying filters and staying indoors.
David.
And let's not forget about the businesses in these areas who rely on this. I mean, it's a big week for North Florida with the Players Championship here. I'm sure those organizers were not looking forward to having smog all week. And, you know, anybody who's working outside, any of your public works, your utility company employees, that sort of thing, they're not having a great time this week either.
Yeah, it's like 1998 all over again.
Exactly.
We're seeing the same fire pattern, and what it's really going to take is tropical storms, tropical depressions, waves, whatever, coming through, because we need that sustained rain to hit that swamp, and until it does without, like, real lightning, then we're going to have this issue. So we're in for this for another couple months.
Yeah, Fred, hopefully that storm is coming through soon.
Well,
we don't usually wish for those storms, but now we are.
Well, I mean, we would like for them to come through, and we'll get a spotty rain. But when you look at the 3 week, 4 week forecast, you look out, there just isn't a lot of there. We're not seeing anything develop in the Atlantic at this point that would give us any hope for this. It just doesn't look good. And even with that, the predictions are still for this particular fire to go on all summer because they've already looked at the forecast. What makes this additionally difficult is that the firemen cannot get there. But basically, you're just establishing fire breaks to try to keep this contained. And that is, as Chief Curtis Wilson just indicated here, we've still got issues here in and around Jacksonville, Duval County, out there in McClinney, that are going to occur because of lightning strikes, because of mistakes. Folks, whenever you see somebody burning anything in your neighborhood, you need to tell them to stop, because this is just not pretty. Now, one other thing I want to note, though, there is a little movement going on among some of the communities to support the firefighters who are up there. A lot of Jacksonville firefighters are having to go, rotating in. They do need supplies. There's a movement to try to help them keep them fed and hydrated while they're up there, because they're running low on supplies.
Yeah.
We have to remember, all of this is exacerbated by the fact that we're also in a water shortage. We're in a statewide drought, but particularly in our area, we have a really bad water shortage. And so it'll be interesting to see how this affects, if at all, the political conversation over withdrawals from the St. John's River, over withdrawals for the Sleepy Creek Lands Ranch from Silver Springs. This may be a much larger political issue down the road.
That's a very good point as well. All right, let's talk politics. Speaking of which, the governor's race factoring into our headlines this week. Gubernatorial candidate Gwen Graham came to town and she channeled her dad, former Governor Bob Graham, by participating in a workday Wednesday in Jacksonville. She spent the day at Operation New Hope learning how to be part of their process, experiencing workers' typical workday at the city's largest ex-felon reentry program. Now, the governor's race is 18 months away, the election, but the field is getting crowded. Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam has declared he's running on the Republican side. Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran is considering a run as well. And Graham will have competition on the Democratic side of the ledger. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum and Winter Park businessman Chris King have announced to run. Attorney John Morgan is widely expected to make a race for this as well. Let us know your thoughts as the governor's race is already heating up a year and a half out from Rick Scott leaving the governor's mansion in Tallahassee. A.G. Gankarski, how successful can Gwen Graham be in taking a leaf out of her father's playbook and doing these work days and going around the state? Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam is also making a tour around the state this week.
Yeah, let's split that up one by one. You know, Graham, she's got a better general election candidate than a primary candidate in some respects. Gillum is going to be able to shore up the left of the party. We'll see how many moderate Democrats there actually are voting in the primary, because Gillum's going to have that Soros money. You know, he's going to basically run a Bernie-crat kind of campaign. So it's going to be interesting to watch that. It's going to be a dogfight going forward, especially if Morgan gets in. Look out. On the Republican side, you know, Putnam right now has to be looked at as a presumptive nominee. He's got $7 million banked. He's got the best name ID statewide. He's got the chits in the local Republican parties. People like Corcoran, Richard Corcoran, the Speaker of the House, Senator Jack Latvala from Tampa area. People like that don't have the statewide name ID. They don't have the network. So it's going to be an uphill battle for them. But, you know, the thing with Putnam and Graham both is they aren't exactly, they lack color, you know, and, you know, they're down
Adam
home.
Putnam's got very colorful
Red hair. But, you know, can you quote one thing Adam Putnam says? He's had a statewide profile for 8 years. And, you know, that's kind of the thing. You're going to need a candidate that gets a little juice, like Rick Scott did 8 years ago.
And can John Morgan provide that kind of zing, given that he's on TV every 5 minutes and on the radio and is known as the face of medical marijuana in the state? Will people take him seriously
if he runs
for governor?
If he wants to, he can be the liberal Florida Trump. I mean, he really can. He
and how has will that same type of how will Donald Trump factor in 2018? David Cotton, Democratic nominee, are they going to run hard against Donald Trump and say let's take Florida back into the blue column, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, if you think about what Gwen Graham has been saying, I mean, not particularly against Trump, but more speaking to the gridlock in Tallahassee,
yeah.
I think that's already kind of becoming her narrative there. I think Adam Putnam is probably going to be that kind of candidate, you know, against, you know, that's going to be his narrative, I think, along the lines of the, you know, Trump deal there.
Fred.
Well, I think they're both correct. Adam Putnam has been in office for quite some time, a decade or more, plus his congressional time, as I understand it, and people still don't know him. I mean, he will get the, as it stands right now, unless something really earth-shaking happens, he'll probably be the Republican nominee. But the fact is, what is he running on? Is he running on fiscal responsibility? Is he running on turning Florida around? Is he going to bring the movie industry back? What is he running on other than we need to stay in control?
And if it's Putnam against Graham,
yeah.
Who wins that? If it's Putnam against, say, John Morgan, who comes out on top there?
Well, you know, he's got to be for the people.
A lot of variables. I don't make predictions.
It's early to predict that, but it will be a fascinating race, won't it?
Yeah, I mean, we got to see, you know, how the operatives play it. And, you know, if anybody can make Oppo dump stick and so forth, there's a lot of ball to be played here.
I mean, Putnam and Graham are basically mirror images. You have the left-leaning centrist and compromiser, and then you have the right-leaning centrist and compromiser. In Adam Putnam, he's definitely not as far right as someone like Richard Corcoran. And then you also have on the left, you have John Morgan all the way to the left. And then kind of Gillum is sort of in the middle in between, I would say, ideologically speaking, between Graham and Morgan. So we'll see how that food fight turns out.
All right. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. And somebody mentioned the Players' Championship.
Oh, yeah, really?
Only in Florida do golfers kill ducks with a powerful drive. Amateur golfer Ryan Gray hit a once-in-a-lifetime shot while teeing off on the 18th hole at TPC Sawgrass when his ball struck a nearby duck and seemed to kill it.
Duck didn't duck.
The incident was captured on film. Video on social media showed Gray looking disbelieving after the unfortunate bird plummets into the water. You could say he hit a birdie.
I guess he quacked up.
He quacked that duck.
And only in Florida does a man readily admit to police, yes, I'm a drug dealer, during a routine traffic stop. 35-year-old Kenneth Harrison made the confession when he failed to signal a left turn and was pulled over in Crestview. As the officer approached, he saw Harrison dumping items on the ground. As he approached the car cautiously, these days most police do that, the officer saw three suspected marijuana cigarettes on the asphalt.
Three little birds, quote Bob Marley.
Hey, you've got to get rid of the evidence. Harrison was ordered to step out of the vehicle, but right before he ran away, he did let the officer kindly know that, in fact, he is in the drug dealing profession. Harrison is under arrest.
Pusher man gets pulled to jail.
I need a sidekick on these jokes, and thankfully, AG always provides it. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And thanks to our panel so much for being here. Fred Matthews, Ryan Bank, A.G. Gankarski, and David Cotton. Thanks for all your hard, hard work covering the news. And thank you for being here. Have a great weekend, you guys.
You too. Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABChurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Next time on 1A, it's the Friday News Roundup. Time to cut through the noise.
Why do you fire Jim Comey without warning?
I think all Trump has to do today is be quiet.
He was not doing a good job.
After all the drama, we'll take a moment to catch our breath on the FBI, on health reform, and on the headlines from outside Washington. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
There's a power when you stand over a sea of people that are bumping, grinding, shaking, all of them waiting for you to decide the next beat. Snap Judgment proudly presents Hey DJ. Snap Judgment, cinema of sound, storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, Nancy Capello was always diligent about eating healthy, getting her mammograms, exercising. So she was stunned when she got a mammogram in 2003, and then later doctors felt a ridge in her right breast and sent her back for another mammo, an ultrasound. It revealed a lesion later determined to be stage 3 breast cancer that had metastasized. Nancy learned she had dense breast tissue. That affects about 40% of all women, and it can make detecting cancer on a mammogram difficult. Capello, an award-winning breast cancer advocate and legislative activist, is going to share her story about this next week here at WJCT at a free event. The Sisisky Kaplinger Annual Endowed Lecture for Women's Health. I spoke with Nancy Capello about this important message she has for all women. Take a listen. Nancy Capello, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Melissa.
This is a topic of such interest for so many women in our area. Can you take us back to how this all began when you first got a mammogram with normal results, but then something happened after that? What was that?
Oh, Melissa, I'm telling you, I never thought that I would be speaking about my breasts. Now they're senior breasts. They weren't senior at the time, in 13 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, all over the country. It's crazy. So anyway, I ended up, I was a very faithful consumer mammography because my mom and my aunt had their yearly mammograms. And, you know, I didn't have any risk factors that would alert me as a high-risk patient other than being a woman and certainly getting older. I was premenopausal at the time. It was in 2004. I had just had my 11th normal mammogram. I was never called back for extra films, you know, and I was, again, only doing it for one purpose. In the unlikely event that I'm diagnosed with breast cancer, it would be found at its earliest stage. And so being a faithful patient and, you know, eating healthy, exercising daily, I went to my gynecologist like 6 weeks after my 11th normal mammogram. And as she was examining my breast, she felt this, what she called a thickening in my right breast, and sent me for another mammogram. Now, keep in mind, Melissa, you know, I thought, no big deal. My friends get called back. The mammogram, when this ridge was felt, was still normal. Because there was a palpable something, the standard of practice is you do an ultrasound. And lo and behold, I had one technologist, and before you know it, I had four folks, a very good-looking doctor hovering over me, examining my breast. Fast forward, stage 3C breast cancer. My cancer had metastasized, traveled to 13 lymph
nodes. Oh, wow. And at that point, you learned you had dense breast tissue. That affects millions of women. Doesn't it make detecting cancer on a mammogram more difficult?
Yes. Well, the crazy part about it, it wasn't that much. Now I have a team of doctors, like six doctors now. Now, I went to them each, you know, separately, and it wasn't like they were fully disclosing this to me, like, oh, Nancy, oh, yeah, oh, by the way. No, I had to basically arm wrestle them to say, what happened? I don't get it. And I honestly, Melissa, I was stunned. It just didn't make any sense to me. I had my reports, you know, dear Ms. Capello, we are pleased to inform you the results of your mammogram are normal. I'm thinking, maybe something's wrong here. Maybe they made a mistake. And so finally, after arm wrestling each of my docs, I said, what happened? I'm good. I just had my own mammogram. I had 11 of them. And each of them proceeded to tell me in a nonchalant manner, oh, yes, you have dense breast tissue. I'm like, what? What's that? Now, being an educator, I had my pad and my pen, and I write down dense breast tissue with this big question mark. And they proceeded to tell me that the type of breast that I have, there's four categories of breast tissue. I had extremely dense breast, which makes it harder for mammograms to see cancer. Now, getting that information from six of my docs did not help me. I actually, when I was having my single mastectomy and I was recovering from my surgery, I had 3 weeks off from work. I went to the literature, and Melissa, this is what shocked me, and this is what your listeners really need to hear. 40% of women have dense tissue. Oh, my God, I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. Another woman. What about my friends, my sister, my cousins, my neighbors? As the density of the breast increases, again, there's four categories of density, the reliability of the mammogram plummets. And at the time, 2004, there are additional tools such as ultrasound and MRI. There's other tools now in addition to that that can find cancer, significantly find detect cancers that are missed on mammograms. I just could not believe it. Mm-hmm. Could not believe it. So I went back to my doc, and I said, okay, shouldn't you start telling women that? And they said to me, each of them, six of them, females included, no, we can't do that, Nancy. It's not the standard of practice.
And so you decided to make it standard.
I did. So, Melissa, I mean, I was devastated. I still am. I mean, I'm thinking,
you know, the first thing you want to know is, am I going to live or die? And I go to the American Cancer Society stage of diagnosis in 2004, and it says, stage 3C, less than 50% of women, 49% of women survive 5 years. And I never, ever missed an appointment. And I knew that there were thousands of women in my community. And I didn't think, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to work on bills all over the nation, including Florida. I just wanted to help my friends and my neighbors and my colleagues at the State Department of Education where I worked. And so my husband had a former classmate that was not a senator in Connecticut, state senator, and he went to her and he told her, and we disclosed all the research that I received, that I got, that I studied, and she was the first person who said to me, not my success, she was the one who said to me, that it's like a legislator, which is crazy, said to me, well, Nancy, I'm going to help you. And because of Senator Hartley, fast forward, we were the first state to provide insurance coverage for women with dense tissue through ultrasound. And in 2009, which is really the watershed moment, we became the first state to disclose dense breast tissue to the patient through the mammography report. And since then, totally 31 states across the nation. And sadly, Florida is not one of them.
Right. But you will be speaking about this here at WJCT Studios so that women in Florida can become more educated about this.
Absolutely. I'm so excited. I'm going to be at Baptist Health, who's actually sponsoring me, and we are going to have an event on May 17th at the studios of WJCT. And you can find information on the Baptist Health website. There's a lot of information about the event. It actually begins at 5:15 with a cocktail hour, so come see me. And the program begins at 6. But it's really about what I've learned, Melissa, is that you really have to be your own advocate, that you really have to take control, whether it's breast health or some other thing. I mean, I have a 9-year-old mother who has some health issues, and I'm telling you, if we didn't take control over her health issues, my mom still wouldn't be alive. So it's really important to really be smart about not just your breast health, but a lot about your health.
Nancy Capello, thanks for sharing this with us.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. And I hope that in the next session that we will get a dental reporting legislation in Florida to protect women from missed delay in advanced cancer.
That's Nancy Capello, and she will speak Wednesday night at WJCT. It is a free event. Register online now. Well, this year at the Players Championship, Morgan Stanley will be promoting Eagles for Impact. For each Eagle a player shoots, $5,000 will go toward the Ronald McDonald House Charities of Jacksonville and helping to renovate their family room at Wolfson Children's Hospital. It's an example of the incredible charitable impact of the players. Diane Boyle is Executive Director of Ronald McDonald House Charities here in town and joins us now. Hey, Diane, good morning.
Good morning.
What a great idea. And how many Eagles have been shot so far? How much have they raised?
Well, we had a great first day yesterday and 12 Eagles were made. And
wow.
We just checked and there were 2 more made this morning.
Oh, how exciting. All this is money that's going to go toward the family room at Ronald McDonald House. How will this be used?
Yes. Morgan Stanley has so generously offered to support the Ronald McDonald House in the renovation of the Ronald McDonald family room at Wolfson's Children's Hospital. It is a place of respite for community members here in Jacksonville when they visit their children in the hospital. And it's staffed by volunteers, and we're expanding the footprint of it to include a rooftop garden.
Oh, how exciting. Now, this is going way beyond Ponte Vedra. They're broadcasting this whole thing on the Morgan Stanley building signage in the heart of Times Square, so people can follow along. They can follow along on social media each time an Eagle is made. The hashtag is Eagle Up. And I think there's even a chalet out at TPC Sawgrass. What's the action out there showing?
Oh, it's very exciting. Out on the 15th hole, right behind the 15th green, Morgan Stanley has set up a simulator tent. And fans are welcome to come into the tent and try their hand at making an eagle and contributing to the initiative.
They are pledging to donate $5,000 for every eagle made, up to $250,000. That's a huge help toward Ronald McDonald House.
Yes, they've become such a wonderful and generous partner of ours, and we're just so appreciative.
And beyond the tournament, I know that you'd love for people to support Ronald McDonald House any day of the year. How can they do that?
Yes. Well, they can go to our website, rmhcjacksonville.org, and learn about the Ronald McDonald House. We would love for anyone to come and take a tour, learn more about our organization, about our mission, and possibly become a volunteer. Or support us.
Because when children are getting life-saving care, the strain on their families, the parents and the siblings, can be overwhelming. That's where you come in.
Yes, that is where we come in, and that is our mission. We are a home away from home for families who need to be in Jacksonville near a hospital when their child is receiving medical treatment. And at the Ronald McDonald House, we provide lodging, meals, transportation. But importantly, we help to ease the financial burden associated with healthcare.
Well, let's hope for more eagles.
Absolutely. Eagle up.
Eagle up. Follow on the hashtag Eagle Up and support Ronald McDonald House as Morgan Stanley is up and running with its Eagles for Impact initiative, helping to raise money for Ronald McDonald House. Diane Boyle is executive director of the charity here in Jacksonville. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
And of course, the Players Championship is going on this weekend. Also, Sunday is Mother's Day, of course. And after you make sure the special mom in your life gets that well-deserved breakfast in bed and hopefully some other goodies, well, there are lots of other options around town to make sure she has a great day. Terry Mashour runs the website Fun for First Coast Kids. She's on the line now with some ideas. Hi, Terry. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So on your website, you have a lot of ideas for the moms and kids out there. What do you have cooking?
We do. This is not your mother's Mother's Day. It's not just breakfast in bed with flowers and a card anymore. There's lots of fun, unique events and specials and brunches. So the first idea is to visit a farm. Amazing Grace Crop Maze is a local farm in Green Cove Springs. They'll have farm animals tomorrow, bouncing, wagon rides, and just farm-tastic family fun. You can take mom tomorrow. Additionally, the Jacksonville Public Library is going to do muffins for mom at the Mandarin Branch tomorrow. You can get some muffins and juice and check out some books. And of course, you were just talking about the Players' Championship, the biggest thing in Jacksonville right now. Head there Sunday for Mother's Day for Pink Out for Donna. The players wear pink, the course is transformed with pink flowers, guests wear pink, and proceeds go to the Donna Foundation to end breast cancer.
Very nice. Now, you have some specials you want to make sure all the moms out there hear about. Stuff they can do for free. What's happening?
Sure. Moms love freebies.
Yes,
so
we do.
Everybody loves freebies. Moms swim free at Adventure Landing. You can jump free at Rebounders and get a free mimosa there. The Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens is doing a free admission for mom with one paid admission. Moms skate free at Skate Station, which is kind of fun. And you can get a free cube of candy for mom with a $40 purchase at Sweet Peach Candy.
And this is all on Sunday?
This is all throughout throughout the weekend.
All throughout the weekend.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Sweet Pete's. The restaurant next door, Candy Apple Cafe, they have a brunch special. There's some taking your mom to brunch is always a nice thing to do. There are lots of places that people need to be on the lookout for. Some good specials this weekend?
Exactly. Brunch is traditional for Mother's Day, but try something unique. So again, visit a candy store. Candy Apple Cafe has Mother's Day specials, and then head next door to get some candy. Try brunch with animals. The Jacksonville Zoo has a special brunch where they'll bring in some animals and have crafts for the kids. How about some brunch with beer? I think that would be my choice. Wicked Barley Brewing Company has bottomless mimosas.
Nice. I think that'd be more my husband's choice, but maybe I'll pass this on to him. Brunch with beer on Sunday at Wicked Barley Brewing Company?
Exactly. And moms get a free mead mosa, so you can get a free beer. And lastly, head to a museum. NOLA at the Museum of Contemporary Art has a Mother's Day brunch as well.
Oh, very nice. Now, if you didn't catch all this, just go to Terry's website, funforfirstcoastkids.com. Fun, the number four, firstcoastkids.com. It is Mother's Day, so find something good to do for the mom in your life. Terry Mashore, thanks so much for jumping on the phone with us this morning. Have a great weekend.
You too. Happy Mother's Day.
All right, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We always want your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and download the WJCT app. Get our podcast anytime or on iTunes. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a wonderful Mother's Day, a great time at the Players, or whatever you choose to do this weekend. Enjoy it.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.